Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Welcome to It's Hot In Here, your weekly environmental talk show with news, views, and grooves about environmental issues. This is Rebecca Harden, holding it down one more time, but only long enough for Jennifer Johnson, a founder of our show, to get rolling from the Elm City in Connecticut to Tree Town back here in Ann Arbor and join us in the studio for some radio this summer. Yes, that's right. Listeners will recall from last year, this is our very first summer broadcasting from the FM studios here in Ann Arbor, and you're bearing with us as we learn the ropes. Today in studio, I have some fabulous guests for you, and I'm so excited about the fact that the Food Sovereignty Conference is on this week. You heard about it last week. We gave you a little teaser. And we're so excited this week to have several of the scholars in town for that event with us today to talk about their research, talk about their work. In studio, I have also my student production team partner, Bailey Schneider, who's in the room and will be often on the mic with questions and comments about food sovereignty. Also, all the way from Budapest, Central European University, we have Guntra Ayastara, who's here. And she's been working in Costa Rica and Latvia, as well as teaching in universities that span the UN Peace University in Costa Rica. And as I mentioned, Central European University. Welcome, Guntra.
Hello.
I should say welcome back, Guntra, because you were here for several years doing your dissertation work, correct?
Yes, I was here originally for a master's degree, then worked for several years and came back for a PhD.
Well, welcome back. And we can't wait to hear more about where your work is going. I also have in the studio Annette Desmarais, who is fresh from her keynote address at yesterday's conference opening panel, in which she was asked to talk a little bit both about the history of the Via Campesina movement and the theories of food sovereignty that are emerging as people start to really analyze the growing food sovereignty movement. Welcome, Annette. Thank you for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you for inviting me to come here.
Well, we sort of grabbed you and dragged you in here, so it's a bit sudden, and I really appreciate you coming because your comments yesterday really interested me, and your vantage point, both as a scholar, as a farmer, as I understand it, right? Before you did your PhD in geography, you were, and maybe still are, an active farmer. Is that correct?
Actually, I farmed for about 14 years. I quit farming about a good 10 years ago, but I was a cattle and grain farmer in Saskatchewan, the province of Saskatchewan in Canada.
Well, as I said, a remarkable scope then for your vantage point on food sovereignty movements, both in Canada and other parts of the world. We'll be back with both of these guests to talk more about what exactly is food sovereignty and what is going on about it on our campus this afternoon that some of you listeners might just want to head over and check out. In the meantime, let me start us off with a tune. I'm going to play a little B.B. King because his loss is still so fresh in our minds here at WCBN. And listening this week to my erstwhile colleagues on the radio, I've heard quite a bit of B.B. King. Some of it more the Cook County, Live at Cook County tracks. I'm going to play one off of Indianola, Mississippi Seeds. And I want my listeners to take a moment with me to just muse on the passing of the ambassador of Chicago blues, B.B. King. Also, the agrarian roots, of course, of a lot of his music. And in fact, the cover, I think, of Indianola, Mississippi Seeds is a big watermelon sliced open and a guitar. You know, it's like a mix of instrument and food, which seems to me really appropriate for the food sovereignty show and the more summertime show. So let's hear a little bit of B.B. King, and we'll be back with food sovereignty conversations. Thanks for listening. If you all have anything in particular that you'd like to hear or any questions you'd like to ask our guests in studio today, you know that you can always reach us at 734-763-3500. It'll ring in the studio, and although we cannot broadcast your phone calls, we are always happy to take them. B.B. King, and we'll be back.
I call it King Special. The reason I do it is because I got the idea of a train. But I want it with a beat so a person can dance to it if they want to.
chronic disease with a little name. By chance his girlfriend came across a needle and soon she did the same. At home there are 17-year-old boys and their idea of fun is being in a gang called the Disciples, high on crack, toting a machine gun. Church and kill everyone inside. You turn on the telly and every other story is telling you somebody died. My sister killed a baby because she couldn't afford to feed it. It was sending people to the moon. In September, my cousin tried reefer for the very first time. Now he's doing horse. It's June. Neighbors just shine at home. But if a night falls and a bomb falls, will anybody see the dawn? Time.
And those of you listeners out there will remember that music is our banner music for the environmental news that we read on the air. And I want to just take a listen to some of the news headlines that aren't so obvious this week. And I was looking for things as I reviewed news stories in preparation for the show. I was looking through some of my favorite sources, including the IRIN reports. Those are reports on human security and human rights issues worldwide. And in looking at the media, I noticed that the latest assessment by UN-backed Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, reports that up to 21,000 Mauritanians are suffering extreme food insecurity this week. It's particularly bad. Now, Mauritania is a country affected by climate change and climate-related shocks, but it's also a place that has had increasing struggles with poverty. There was a deep drought in 2012 in Mauritania that left more than 800,000 people in need of humanitarian assistance. And at the moment, things have gradually been worsening since that time. I believe that we should turn to these African sites in which, you know, a combination of land and climate and poverty are creating increasingly precarious situations in a lot of regions. And they're not just biological or ecological drivers. You also have political instability. A region like Marawa, Cameroon, also popped up in the IRN news report. And that's, you know, something you can find online at www.irinnews.org. And the Marawa, Cameroon situation is one that's caused, yes, by underlying climate extremes to some extent, but more recently by the upsurge in Boko Haram activity. And it seems as though as many as 180,000 people in the region of Marawa could be at risk of acute food crises this year. This is, you know, these are warnings coming from aid organizations and local authorities. And a lot of folks have fled the area because of political instability and concern about violence. Now, even during times of peace, northern Cameroon is plagued by water shortages and harsh climate. They're increasingly reliant on deep boreholes to grow food at all. And at the same time, who knows whether such boreholes become themselves stakes in the expansion of militias that need water and need food. There's been such interesting work lately questioning the role of food aid itself. Also, I was reading a piece recently on the deadly underside of food aid that suggests, and this is a relatively new study by Yale and Harvard economists, that suggests that an unintended consequence of aid to developing countries is increasing reliance on food imports, which really gets at some of the questions of food sovereignty on the one hand, and then, you know, as a kind of structural underlying set of issues that play out over time, even in relatively food secure environments, and then how those issues come to a head in conditions of real food insecurity. I want to talk about the differences between those two ideas, but first let me just note that while I was doing my research on these news stories for this week's Sign of the Times environmental news report, I realized that the IRIN, which kind of started by distributing humanitarian news about Central Africa out of faxes from a tiny Nairobi office in 1995, it was kind of an underground, on-the-ground report that lots of us would look to see what wasn't getting picked up by mainstream media. And over the years, it won lots of awards and coverage expanded all the way across the African continent, even into other regions like the Middle East and Southeast Asia. The reports were coming out in French, English, Arabic, and had lots of online audiences. But relatively recently, it has been delinked in some ways from its United Nations connections and instead created as a nonprofit independent media outlet with a grant of about $25 million from the Genwell Charitable Foundation Limited, which is a philanthropic initiative linked to a third generation Chinese family business, Hong Kong family. And so I thought that was really interesting in an era of increasingly diverse independent media, but also a time when social media and digital media are growing in such unpredictable ways and will have really interesting relationships to reporting on food sovereignty and food security issues. So just a heads up, IRIN isn't what you remember it to be. Take a look at their new website, their slick new media with lots and lots of African guys with guns telling you not to look away because something bad's going to happen next. I wasn't sure how I felt about it. Would love to hear from you listeners about, you know, not only what are we talking about with food access and food production, but how are we talking about it and how do we get our information about it? Really interesting questions for us here at WCBN-FM. And I want to open it up just a little bit today and talk about this question of food security and food sovereignty. For those of you who've seen the poster from this week's Michigan meetings, and those are happening yesterday and today at the Dana Building, 440 Church Street, downtown Ann Arbor, you will note that there is a huge constellation of people from many countries and many disciplines talking about connections between urban and rural, developed, industrialized, and developing economies, different cultural groups and subcultural groups on food sovereignty. They're defining food sovereignty as a conceptualization of world problems in food and agriculture that emerges from peasant farmers, fishers, and farm workers, emphasizing social equality rather than production and profit at its core. This conceptualization emerges from the International Peasant Umbrella Organization, La Via Campesina. And the Michigan meeting was funded, I should note, by the Horace H. Rackham School of Graduate Studies here at the University of Michigan, without which none of this could happen. But let me turn to some of our guests in studio and just ask briefly, if you could unpack La Via Campesina for us, for our listeners who may not be familiar with that movement. I know, Annette, you spoke about it yesterday. In fact, you opened your speech yesterday with a really important statement of debt, intellectually and politically, to that movement for kind of creating the concept of food sovereignty. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, La Via Campesina was actually started in 1993, It really was the result of a lot of exchanges that had taken place among various farm organizations in the global north and in the global south. These exchanges were north-south, south-south-north-north. And what farmers did in those exchanges, and these were delegations of organizations that would, you know, travel to each other's countries and stay there for about anywhere from 1 week to 2 weeks to even 6 weeks. And the aim of those exchanges was to get a really good sense of what was happening in agriculture in each other's countries, and also talk about, you know, what are some of the organizational strategies that the farm organizations had been involved in to try to change, to effect change in rural areas. And so in 1993, something like 45 of those representatives of organizations from Asia, Africa, the Americas, Europe, got together in a place called Mons, Belgium. And at that meeting, they decided, and this was 1993, this was just before the WTO had signed its agreement, its agreements, but more specifically the agreement on agriculture, which was geared to just transform rural landscapes in very significant ways. And so the Via Campesina, well, was formed at that meeting in 1993. Farmers decided that they needed to work together to resist the efforts of the WTO and other international organizations that wanted to globalize agriculture, globalize this corporate-led neoliberal model of agriculture. And so farmers decided that, and peasants decided that they needed to work together and really mount a challenge to that whole model, that there was another type of agriculture that was in fact being practiced, and that we needed to take the responsibility to work together and on further developing that alternative agriculture. So the Via Campesina started off with 45 organizations, and it quickly grew, and now involves about 200 organizations from 80 countries. It represents millions and millions of peasant farmers, of farm workers, of indigenous agrarian communities, rural women, small-scale and medium-sized farmers from, again, those regions of the world, Asia, Africa, the Americas, Europe, and the Middle East now is really becoming an important part of the Via Campesina.
That's interesting and must also be challenging in many respects, given the broader politics of interregional relationships here. But I'm impressed, and I was impressed in your comments yesterday by the way you talked about, well, kind of what you reached into geography and pulled out as frameworks for understanding this. You quoted Doreen Massey, kind of really interesting feminist geographer, post-structuralist geographer, who talks about a kind of sophisticated relationship both to struggles within places and to the relations among places in her work on social movements and space, spatial relationships. And you really were discussing this remarkable thing that's happened with Via Campesina, where there is a kind of immersion by many members in local, very local struggles, and at the same time, a huge awareness of different but related struggles in other places. And that seems to be, from the history you just gave us, and for our listeners who missed that first part of the comment, Annette was telling us that Via Campesina had its origins in 1993. It's been looking both inward and outward all this time. It's kind of incredible to me, actually. And I wonder, you mentioned early roles for yourself as someone taking notes and observing meetings. How did you yourself become involved in all this?
Well, I was a farmer for about 15 years or 14 years. And so I actually was politicized through my experience as a volunteer in Nicaragua. In the late 80s, we had a project called the Farmers Brigades to Nicaragua, which were geared to essentially bring machinery parts from Canada to Nicaragua because of the U.S. embargo. Nicaraguan farmers couldn't actually obtain the parts that they needed to fix their machinery. So we would bring the parts, the machinery parts, and also teach the Nicaraguan farmers how to maintain their machinery, because the Sandinista government had actually
mechanized the countryside, but did not have sufficient resources to follow up with extension services and actually teach people how to use that machinery, how to take care of the machinery. So that was our job. And of course, we then would come back to Canada and work very, very hard to educate the Canadian population and put a lot of pressure on the Canadian government to try to change the U.S. position, essentially. So that I was politicized, and which meant that when I got back home, I actually quickly joined the National Farmers Union, and they ultimately were founding members of the Via Campesina. So getting to this question of, you know, how do they work together? I think that's so important to understand, because that's what food sovereignty is all about. I mean, you know, at the second international conference of the Via Campesina, which was held in Tlaxcala, Mexico, you know, there were about, I think, 200 delegates at that conference. And the aim of the conference was to figure out how was the Via Campesina going to work together? What were they going to do together? You know, everyone was quite aware of the fact that there was a great need to resist the WTO and national governments that were adopting the neoliberal approach to agriculture. But there was also, I mean, resistance for the Via Campesina meant also building something new. And that's how food sovereignty came about.
And so backing up a little for our listeners, just to unpack our terminology here, I mean, many of us are familiar with the notion of the neoliberal as a gloss for the kinds of economic reforms that came out of the late 80s Washington consensus meetings, in which economists and policymakers and key decision makers decided that one of the things that was needed was economic reform to shrink some of the sizes of state apparatus, to foster freer market mechanisms. And so there was a kind of, a kind of decision to really alter in many ways the politics that had characterized a first few decades of post-World War II development with cooperatives and state-funded initiatives. It really changed the way rural relationships and urban centers, you know, connected to one another within a lot of the developing world and here in the U.S. and in Canada. So I just wanted to sort of do that little homework of unpacking those terms. Of course, one of the things I've appreciated in Annette's sort of history, and Annette, I should mention, has written a wonderful book, La Via Campesina, Globalization and the Power of Peasants, published in 2007, which really does offer a comprehensive history of these issues and this movement. And that seems, I guess, a bit later down the road from your politicization in Nicaragua on the one hand, your joining of the Farmers Union in Canada subsequently, and then, I mean, at what point are you getting a PhD and becoming what you are now, which is the Canada Research Chair in Human Rights, Social Justice, and Food Sovereignty at the University of Manitoba? When did you become also a scholar?
Well, I'm an accidental academic, I have to admit. I had worked with the Via Campesina for about 10 years because I was the coordinator of the Global Agriculture Project, and my job was to facilitate the development of linkages between the National Farmers Union of Canada with counterparts in other countries, specifically in the Global South. And so I did that for 10 years. That meant that I was actually working with the Via Campesina for about 10 years. And then the funder of this project decided that this kind of political work was just a little too political and wanted to shift my job description to one of doing only fundraising. Which I couldn't do. I refused to do. And so I asked the Via Campesina at that point if they thought it would be a valuable exercise to actually do a study of the movement, because the movement had been in existence for 5 years by that time. And it was a time when we were trying to figure out, okay, so where do we go next?
Right.
And so I asked them if they thought that a PhD study would be appropriate, and they agreed to do it as long as it was a participatory research endeavor, in which it was. And that's how I came to do the PhD and later on published the book on the Via Campesina.
And now, indeed, in some of your closing comments yesterday, to think more and more about the role of research and research institutions in some of these social movements, which I think is really interesting. Let me just take us to one more musical track to animate this conversation. It's one that I think I really do love for this particular topic, and it's a tune by Eric Clapton called Let It Grow, which again seems like a really appropriate tune for a conversation about food sovereignty. So I'm going to play some Eric Clapton, and we will be back with Annette Desmarais, Guntra Ayestara, and Bailey Schneider holding it down with me here. It's very hot in here, listeners. We've also had a phone call or two we're going to fill you in on. Folks are listening, and they're sharing some of their own stories and travels across landscapes of food sovereignty, so more on that to come when we come back. For now, here's a little Eric Clapton with Let It Grow.
Standing at the crossroads, trying to read the signs, to tell me which way I should go to find the answer, and all the time I know. Your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow. Let it blossom, let it flow. In the sun, the rain, the snow.
Nothing left to show. Plant your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow. Let it blossom, let it flow. In the sun, the rain, the snow.
Welcome back to It's Hot in Here. This is Rebecca Harden in the studio today with Annette Aurélie Desmarais and Guntra Ayastara, both scholars of what we've been calling this hour food sovereignty. And Annette, what do we mean when we say food sovereignty? I read a definition from the poster from today's Michigan meeting happening here on Michigan's campus all afternoon. But how would you sum up what is food sovereignty to us at the moment?
Well, I would say that in a nutshell, food sovereignty is the rights is the right of countries and peoples to define and control their own food systems, their own modes of food production, their own food environments, their own food cultures. And what is very, very important, I think, to understand about food sovereignty is that it is conceptualized as, and this was what the peasants said when they defined food sovereignty, is that food sovereignty is a prerequisite to food security and the human right to food. So in other words, without food sovereignty, without having the power to make decisions about who controls the food system, what is grown, how it is grown, and you know who grows it and at what scale, if you don't have the power to make those decisions, then it will be almost impossible, if not clearly impossible, to actually ensure the human right to food and food security.
So hearing you define food sovereignty thus, I am reminded of yesterday how kind of reverently you cited a poem by Eduardo Galeano called The Right to Dream. And I had hoped we might be able to read that poem on air. I certainly will post the links to it that you mentioned on our blogcast, which goes live over the weekend. So Fridays we broadcast, Saturdays we blogcast with a much richer interface that will include links, of course, to my guest Annette Desmarais' research as the Canada Research Chair in Human Rights, Social Justice, and Food Sovereignty at University of Manitoba, but also some of the resources far beyond the ivory tower that she's bringing to the table and that any of us bring if we have been working as partners with communities and artists over time on these issues. And I do think that the way you just defined food sovereignty as fundamentally a right to choose, to reflect and choose and imagine food production in particular ways is really key to those interfaces between technological, political, artistic, kind of, and sacred. There was an emphasis on the sacredness of food in yesterday's plenary as well, right? Which is coming out of Indigenous communities who are pushing back against food as only a commodity. I love that poem. I don't know how you found that poem yourself. It sounds wonderful.
Well, actually, I discovered it because it when there was a lot of mobilization in Spain recently by the Indignados, they were actually using that poem. And what's really special about that poem is that it requires us, it drives us to actually use our capacity to imagine. And I think that that's exactly what the Via Campesina was doing in 1996 when they came up with this idea of food sovereignty, was that, everybody, the whole world was being told there is no alternative to economic globalization. There is no alternative to the globalization of a particular model of agriculture. And what the Via Campesina did instead was actually collectively imagine the alternative. And that meant actually being in a whole lot of debates and discussion and negotiation about what that alternative would look like, given your particular history, given your particular ecology, given your particular place, physical place in the world, and somehow in, facilitating a discussion where people or first of all, creating the political space for you to actually have that discussion, and putting all of that diversity together and imagining together what that alternative looks like. And that's what food sovereignty is. It you cannot have food sovereignty without having some sense of how what you're doing in your community affects
or is influenced by people and places elsewhere.
Well, I know for those of us in Michigan, those are words that ring very, very true. And culturally and politically, there's been such dynamism here. There's a wonderful group of musicians, the Earthworks Collective, that do a lot of recording up in Traverse City and also in Kalamazoo studios. They're linked with farming and farm movements. They are diverse as a kind of collective of different respective artists, but they are absolutely inspirational. And I had hoped we'd have time on the air to play some of their music. We will certainly link to some on our blogcast at www.hotinhere.us tomorrow. But right now, we've had so many phone calls and so many great guests in the studio. I want to keep moving with some of the news about this definition of food sovereignty you're describing, the power to imagine rather than merely to commoditize and to become more efficient. And Guntra, your recent work reminds me of those issues as well. You took a phone call earlier, didn't you, here in the studio from someone who had come back from some of the areas in which you teach. Tell us about what our callers have shared with us today.
Yeah, so we had a call from a gentleman named John Colley, who was recently returned from a trip to Hungary, where I teach at the Central European University, and had noticed that paprika, which used to be a big export product from Hungary, has now become something that they import, and that there's also, he was asking about the changes in not only climate factors, but the changes from the state socialist system to a more capitalist system in agriculture and how that's affected small farmers in these countries.
Well, that's something that must remind you a little bit of some of the change you've documented in your own research, in your own publications in Latvia, no?
Yes, and I told John that I don't actually work in Hungary per se, but that the work of Zsuzsa Gile at the University of Urbana-Champaign would actually be a great resource for him, because she's written about some of the food scandals surrounding paprika in Hungary. And I think she has an article called Toxic Paprika, which is about the fact that new EU regulations on food standards sometimes actually are weaker than the previous food standards. And so they allowed a type of contamination to come in with paprika, with peppers that were being imported from Spain, rather than catching it
locally. Or in more local production.
Yeah.
So that's such a great concrete example of the way that the macro kind of policy and economic frameworks affect the particular kinds of foods that flow through these systems and indeed into our systems as consumers. That's a fascinating report. I love when we open up the studio on Fridays for It's Hot in Here. I do love the way that we get into conversations among scholars and practitioners in Michigan and beyond, talking about things happening all over the world. And it just is one of the true pleasures of community radio that has its base in a research university. It's a really powerful thing. Guntra, your work in Latvia was also describing some of these impacts of sort of consolidation of European Union norms and policies. Tell us more about the way that you saw those processes impacting farmers in Latvia, and then also in your second site, Costa Rica, where it was more about CAFTA and the sort of Latin American, South and Central American scene. Tell us more.
Yeah, thanks. The research that I did for my dissertation was looking at how small farmers in small countries like Latvia and Costa Rica get thrown into these larger trade unions, like the European Union in the case of Latvia, or the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, for Costa Rica, and what that does to farmers' opportunities to imagine their systems and to really do the sort of food sovereignty work that Annette was speaking about. And so many of these, so in Latvia, for example, small farmers regained their land, which had been collectivized under the Soviet Union. They had to reimagine not only a movement, but actually farming practices. Many of them had not farmed, or if they did, they were workers on collective farms, and so they didn't have their own plots of land. They went back to ancestral practices, trying to ask their grandparents where they had planted things on the land 50 years ago.
Wow.
And some of them even didn't have ancestral connections whom to ask, but they would look up everything they could about the previous owners of the land and try to imagine what those people had done then. And yet they had to sort of reimagine in these new conditions with much different economic conditions, what they had to, how they could sell food, how they could produce it. Many of them became organic farmers because they didn't have the money to be buying inputs or
for more conventional agriculture or more vertically integrated agriculture.
And it was also a way of contesting at that time the Soviet system of very heavily mechanized and chemicalized agriculture.
Right, right. Now, I guess, you know, that invention or that sort of turn to heritage, right? The politics of heritage in that climate are really interesting. And that's something that you're doing some work on now as well, the kind of different ways that heritage is used and becomes itself politicized in these movements. I think that's a really fascinating question.
Yeah, the whole politics of heritageization, some of it comes from places like the EU, which has programs to support making certain foods a cultural heritage product, but it doesn't necessarily allow that can standardize in some ways what that product is. And all of the great diversity that different families who each had their own bread recipe and each had their own sourdough, which was the bacteria were very specific to the wooden bread trough in which they fermented the dough. If you standardize those practices, you lose a great deal of what that diversity is and what that cultural heritage means as an embodied food and agricultural practice.
Well, and I recall the sort of surprise with which I read your work on seed. I mean, in that context, seeds like that are heirloom varieties that connect back to a pure lineage of some kind are very valued, whereas you've written about another context in Costa Rica where actually there's a completely different sort of value placed on hybridization and syncretism in seeds, if you will. I mean, I'm talking like a cultural anthropologist here, which I am. But I thought that your work was so great in the way that it both pointed to comparable structural challenges of what you call conventionalism, but also to the really important differences in the ways that people produce and value elements of an agricultural system, right?
Yeah, in Costa Rica, one of the practices that most impressed me were the seed exchanges that farmers had among themselves. And this was partially in reaction to the fact that as their family members with whom they used to exchange seeds became conventional farmers and were buying standardized seeds, hybrids, or other types of seeds, they lost their trading partners for their seeds. And so organic farmers who were still using these, what they call semillas criollas or criol seeds, they were organizing seed exchanges, which they saw as a form of resistance to the type of commodification of agriculture that was happening. And each of these seeds actually represented then both the family histories and the exchanges with other farmers. So these ancestral and social ties were embodied in seeds, which became incredibly meaningful to the farmers. And yet the threat of intellectual property rights being passed in the form of UPOV, or the Plant Variety Protection Convention, which was a requirement of joining CAFTA.
Wow.
That
wow.
completely frightened farmers about their possibilities to continue with these practices of not only growing their own seeds, but exchanging them and continually allowing them to evolve and develop.
So in the end, these kinds of policy frames and trade agreements impact the kinds of genetic mixes that arrive into future generations from ours. I mean, it's like, it's an amazing interface of the social and the ecological or biological when you think of it that way, actually.
Yeah, as well as the social movement possibilities that exist on the ground. So in both countries, what you see is that the types of conventions that governments have to sign to promote free trade place serious limitations on the sovereignty of both the farmers who have designed their own practices and social norms surrounding agriculture, and on the countries who, you know, a state has often negotiated with a social movement about what are the norms of certification, or what's permitted in a certain regulation. And these are agreements which then get violated by the fact that a free trade agreement has a higher standing, and those laws get obliterated. So it's state sovereignty as well as farmer sovereignty that is at stake in these.
So talk to me, Guntra, for a minute. Let's back into a little of the work that we did earlier on the mic with Annette about how you have come into scholarship and teaching on these issues. I know that you are currently an assistant professor in the department, or perhaps associate. I forget where you are at in terms of your progress through all of these various levels of academic achievement, but you're teaching now in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Policy in the Central European University in Budapest. But previously, you were teaching at the UN Peace University in Costa Rica, so making that place not only a field site for you, but a site of engagement with teachers and scholars and students. Can you talk a little bit about how, I want to say, the perils of multi-sited ethnographic work on these issues? Because you've had a multi-sited career and life now. You're kind of a global scholar in a way, but looking at very local issues. How has that played out? Can you talk a little bit about your teaching and your work in these different institutions?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a fascinating trajectory. And I have to say that one of the things that I've loved about teaching at both of these universities that are international universities is that students are coming from all over the world. They teach me much more than I teach them, I'm sure, in the conversations that we have about their experiences with different types of food movements or other experiences. And they also have the opportunity then to go visit, for example, I've been able, when I was teaching in Costa Rica, they could go visit farms with whom I had worked, and I was able to bring these international communities to visit these very local sites and to learn about how what they see in the country that they're living, what is happening that's affecting these farmers on the ground and the food that they're eating as they're there.
Wow. I have to say I think that it's an amazingly rich but also ambitious and unusual kind of career trajectory, and the ability to be able to remain connected in some sense. I mean, so much of this kind of work academically now is done in these very short bursts. And so I really am fascinated and impressed by what you've done. You sent us a little bit of music, Guntra, both from your Costa Rican field sites and from your Latvian field sites. And I know that you were sharing with us music from both Guadalupe Urbina from Costa Rica. You want to tell us a little bit about that music?
Yes. So she's a musician who often came to a lot of the protests against the CAFTA free trade agreement. She came to the different seed exchanges, and her music is based in traditional music from Guanacaste, but also innovating on that, or let's say in the theme of the day, reimagining some of that music. The song that I shared with you is actually one which she wrote about the free trade agreement. And there was an idiom that was being used at the time that it was like a competition between a mule and a tied up mule and a tiger that is let out of the cage. And so that's the competition between that's what a free trade agreement does to the country. And in this song, she talks about how 100 free birds are better than one that is tied up. And so I hope listeners will enjoy listening to this.
So let's try and see if we can get it to play for us. I couldn't find it in any of the online bases I use, Spotify, Grooveshark, etc. But I did find it. You sent me a link. Let's see if we can get it to play. And I did find a lot of beautiful, beautiful music from her. Let's see what we can do here and what we can hear from Guadalupe Urbina.
Mm-hmm. el burro amarrado y el tigre suelto, la esposa casada, el marido soltero. La patria ofrece mano de obra barata a industria extranjera que quiera comprarla. El burro amarrado y el tigre suelto, yo haciendo la tierra, arañando los mares, enciendo las máquinas, curo los cuerpos. Yo enciendo la patria y el tigre anda suelto. Más valen 100 pájaros libres volando bajo este cielo, que a veces tiene tormentas, nubarrones, pero es nuestro. Más valen 100 pájaros libres que uno atado de la pata o apagado en una aula sin agua, sin luz, sin cielo. Hay cosas que en casa no caminan bien y que aquí adentro hace falta oxígeno, pero las maquilas no limpian mi aire. Su tigre anda suelto y mi casa se cae. Mi patria es pequeña, pero me ha costado. Por ella he pagado impuestos y carreras. A mí me pertenece su energía eléctrica, los sistemas de agua y los de la salud. Más valen 100 pájaros libres volando bajo este cielo, que a veces tiene tormentas, nubarrones, pero es nuestro. Más valen 100 pájaros libres que uno atado de la pata o apagado en una aula sin agua, sin luz, sin cielo. Hay reglas que guardo y armas que no compro, guerras que no pago y no puedo inventar. Todo lo que como lo siembro en mi patio. Me cuesta muy caro conservar mi paz. Y si de tratado se trata, decido por mi propia cuenta lo que puedo dar. No hay negociaciones cuando hay desventaja. David no es Goliat, pero sabe pensar. ¿A quién se le ocurre abandonar la casa, dejar que entren otros e irse a alquilar? El tigre anda suelto, pero no hay burro tonto que no se sepa sentar. ¿A quién se le ocurre un río sin cauce, un grano sin campo para florecer? ¿A quién se le ocurre intentar ser otro en lugar de ser lo que realmente es? Más valen 100 pájaros libres volando bajo este cielo, que a veces tiene tormentas, nubarrones, pero es nuestro. Más valen 100 pájaros libres que uno atado de la pata o apagado en una aula sin agua, sin luz, sin cielo. Más valen 100 pájaros libres volando bajo este cielo, que a veces tiene tormentas, nubarrones, pero es nuestro. Más valen 100 pájaros libres que uno.
Welcome back to WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. That was Guadalupe Urbina, a Costa Rican artist, singing about trade agreements and food production and the power to dream and imagine the future for food in her native Costa Rica. Thanks go to Guntra Ayastara, sitting in the studio with me today, for recommending that tune and for talking with us over the phone calls and the hubbub here at It's Hot in Here about her work, both in Latvia and in Costa Rica. I wanted to also let listeners know that although many of our comments today have been focused on Via Campesina and food sovereignty movements internationally, we've talked about everything from paprika in Hungary, thanks to our listeners, to the production of agricultural goods in Central and South America. But we do have also a really remarkable set of panels and discussions this afternoon happening at the Dana Building, 440 Church Street, downtown Ann Arbor. And I wanted to give our listeners just a little information about what's in store before this conference on food sovereignty closes. We have panels this afternoon starting at 2 o'clock p.m., including one on who is the sovereign in food sovereignty, an historical perspective. And that's going to be a talk by Carla Pena, a PhD candidate at Cornell University, followed by our own Dorcida E. Taylor, who's a professor in the environmental justice field of study at the School of Natural Resources and Environment, talking about food acquisition strategies among low-income residents of Grand Rapids. And Dorcida is someone who's been working with a recent large grant from USDA, I believe, on food deserts. How are they being defined? Who's defining them? And what's being done to address them where they do exist? That's work that's going on here in the Michigan, Southeast Michigan, and other areas of the state. Linking some of this international work to our own backyards is what we're always interested in doing here at WCBN-FM and on It's Hot In Here. Finally, at 3:30 p.m. today, we're going to get food sovereignty and deep democracy, food sovereignty and deliberative participatory democracy. That's a talk by Jahi Chappell, the director of agroecology and agriculture policy at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. So we've got a really wide range of folks. And finally, closing it out, 4 o'clock, 4:30 p.m., Peter Rossett, who's a Global Alternatives Associate at CENSA. That's the Center for the Study of Rural Change in Mexico as well. A coordinator of Land Research Action Network, LRAN, talking about food sovereignty as a social movement and strategies of struggle. So this is really about right here in our backyard and other parts of the world, urban and rural, homegrown and increasingly transnational movements around people's capacity both to practice and to imagine and dream about the ways they want to meet their food needs into the future for themselves, for their children, for future generations. And let me just thank, before we close out here today, both of my guests who took time out of the conference to walk over here to the groovy basement of the Student Activities Building where Bailey and I are broadcasting this afternoon and sit down and talk with us about their own lives and work on these issues. I would love to hear from either of you, whether you know of anything coming up in your own research work or in general that would be of interest to listeners on these topics, or otherwise to just let you head on back over to the conference and encourage listeners to contact you there and or to look at our blogcast tomorrow for more links to your up-and-coming work and to your networking in social movements and scholarly circles on these issues. Annette, thank you for being with us. Any final parting words to our listeners?
No, I just really wanted to thank you for the opportunity to do this. I think, people all over the world are getting really excited about work on food and food sovereignty. I mean, people are concerned. I mean, you know, we've had so many food scares and people just don't feel like they have any control anymore of, you know, the food that they're eating. So I would just encourage people, if you're concerned about the food that you eat or the food that you want to eat, then just go out there, find a group that you can work with others, and to try to change it all, because we can take control of our food systems.
That is a wonderful mantra for an area that sees, in fact, right next door, Ypsilanti. Our new mayor of Ypsilanti was someone who founded a movement called Growing Hope for agricultural work in that town. We see it right here as we move from Rust Belt to Green Belt, and it's good to know that it's happening all over the world with so much urgency and energy. Thank you, Annette, for being here. Guntra, any parting words about where you're headed next and what's coming up for you or what you think might be a way forward on these issues for those interested in engaging?
I would also just like to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you and to also interact with Annette, which has been a great pleasure. And I hope that all of our listeners out there will both pay more attention to their food, to the movements that surround them, and to the great diversity of not only foods, but people and movements and interests, and that we can grow a mutual respect and understanding around these issues that will be the foundation of strength for moving forward in all parts of the world.
Thank you so much, both Guntra and Annette. I appreciate you being in here, and I'm going to send us out on a more of an R&B tune. It's Anthony Hamilton's Ball and Chain, which is a song about getting out of the production line in places like the Rust Belt and heading back down south where, as he puts it, tomatoes grow where you can pick them. It's a beautiful food sovereignty tune in its own way, and it reminds us of Motown meets food sovereignty, which, of course, is a part of what's happening today. Thanks for all of you listeners who've called in, and Brandoc's up next. I'm going to give you a little ball and chain to head out. For the Hot in Here production team, thank you to all our listeners, and look for that blogcast tomorrow on our site, www.hotinhere.us. Now we're